the decrease of cemetery harassing. Okay. So the first one is one I'm working on, and it's called Catfish. It's been through a lot of different kind of versions, but something maybe to tell you before I read poems is that sometimes Catfish is called Cat by people fishing it. So in the poem, it's called a cat. Yes, and I'll explain a little bit more about it after I read it, because maybe the poem will explain first. Catfish. The big tongue of his body tastes change. A cloud of mud kicks up, and a twitching, sucking creature wrestles into the nest. His eggs clutch together. Anger, hunger, stew with the digestive juices, and the cat's jaw snaps, clamping down. His prey is big, and the catfish is pulled away from his home. His eggs are left in the nourishing sacks as their father is resurrected, up, breaking the brown blue surface, fins flapping the gut in a vision of his prey, now predator, using his own hand as bait. Crucifixion is quick. The fish's head is nailed to a post outside a family home. The fisherman flays the length of his body, stripping him of white to be fried for his children. Heads lie in the fence as trophies. Their spines, demonic kite strings. If you on YouTube, Google, not on YouTube. If you Google catfish and fence posts, you'll see a really disturbing image. In the place I come from, the States, they have this around the hills where kind of people with very few teeth live. They massive catfish heads stuck on fence posts, and it's, nobody really knows why, some kind of trophy thing, or I don't know. But the other half of this poem is that there's also a kind of thing called hand fishing, but its nickname is noodling. And the man literally sticks his fist into the river or into the nest of a catfish and uses his hand as bait, and the catfish just bait clamps on. I'm fascinated with this for some reason that I can't explain. But you can also, from the Bass Pro Shop, you can also purchase a video of girls gone noodling. Girls in bikinis sticking their hands in catfish nets. I'm not kidding. You can actually buy it. Okay, that's enough. So the last line. Oh god. I want to read a poem by an author I found in the 2008 poetry anthology, Best of American Poetry Anthology. The author is John Chesteen, and the poem is called Night Hunting. Because we wanted things the way they were, in our mind's black eyes we waited. The beaver, raising ripples in a V behind his head, the thing we wanted. A weed is what might grow where you don't want it. A dahlia could be a weed, or love, or other notions. A heart can't choose to find itself enchanted. A hand can't choose to change the shape of water. How strange to hope. To see the signs of motion, to make an end to Peter's old refrain. It'll be long, son of a bitch, and then you best be ready. So sure. And so sure that when he shines the light on the things that will show along the other shore, what next? Well, you've killed animals before. Invited here for company in the cold night, and because ever handy with rifles. What next is wait and see. What next may be the lone report, the ever-widening circles, blood blossoms, the spirit rising slow, like oily smoke above still waters. We wanted a pond to look like a pond. Standing poplars, shallows unsullied, fish and frogs and salamanders. The gleaming back of fur and fat may not be long, or may. God of garments, God of will, forgive us our trespasses. We know precisely what we do. Thanks.
three parts, and the first two parts are almost true insofar as they're actually real rumors I heard as a child. The third part is something I can comprehend. There was Alison O'Leary and Greg Rose, who couldn't stop chewing on her own hair. Long, mousy strands, so coarse and so abundant, no one noticed the absence of hundreds of her scalp. Though naturally sinuous, their own long weight pulled them straight. They curled up in her belly like a nest of indigestible vermicelli, blocking all passage of food. So she died. Then there was the nameless girl from Pierce Road, joyous on her honeymoon in Majorca, 1971, an early charter flight, who, without knowing, ate an exotic rosette-tinged lettuce head with a raw reptilian egg hidden in its clustered organic tongue. In 3 weeks, attached inside her, a creature replete with teeth, 4 feet with claws, which gnawed away at her inside as it grew from inside no more, so she died. A sad little girl near the mock lay all alone at a shop, with blue muffin shells for antelope, and on her vegetable stall, dew-buried, stainless nettles, leaves of dock. As her own customer, she sucked sweet red flesh from the huge fruit before spitting away the poisonous kernel. Of all the leaves, digitalis seemed least bitter and most fruitful, with white and lilac blossoms capping each of her digits, except her toes. She ate one greenery until her heart stopped. Not rich enough to grant himself a send-off awaiting the Emperor's chin. He decided to treat his baby finger to a tomb, lavish, Bijou, to die for. First he dug a trench, huge at 1/72nd scale, in which to inter 5 boxes of unbiodegradable airfix knives, swords and lanterns, bristling in practice. In a pan in which he had once fluxed pewter ingots from mould and Napoleonic grenadiers, he melted commemorative sovereigns and once upon embargoed Kruger hands. We shaped them into bracelet charm war offers and gold, offering minor toy town tasty. 47 veterinary thermometers he snapped in two to extract enough mercury for a miniature lake laid out inside the mausoleum he carved himself from Connemara marble. Mock jade idols formed from lumps of desiccated meridian he arranged in a circle surrounding a soapstone casket lined with butterfly motifed purple silk. Then he tired of Shinwatabi began to study coffee table tomes on Egyptology. He copied varicolored silhouettes of Amun and Isis, Horus and a chorus line of nubile, coal-eyed battles with the Louis Brooks-style haircut, onto panels of modeling also, before slicing the pre-embalmed thumb of his right hand, entombing it along with all of his skills, so no finger after could see the script.
Thanks, Pat. Now we've got Niall Harris.
Hi. I've got two here that kind of fit in with the theme of the Get Poet or one of the themes. First is called The Eliminated, and it's written some time ago, but sort of resurrected. Our Green Party in this country has rolled over to have its tummy tickled by the government's accomplices. But we shouldn't forget those who died for the Green Movement. The Eliminated. It's kind of broadly the Green Movement, shall I say. Ken Saro-Wiwa, hanged by a brutal state, with Machiavellian friends, acting for the rich and great, high over Black Thames mud, far from the oil and blood. You tried to save the rivers, and you're abused of only people, from predators who stalk our world, crocodile men of power. Karen Silkwood, you tried to protect the staff in a troubled nuclear plant, which feeds the golden calf. A lonely, lethal date for a roadside ditch, your fate. Convenience for the company. Papers disappeared. High explosive evidence on toxic men of power. Fernando Pereira, you died when Olympus bomb sank the Rainbow Warrior, sealed your watery tomb in a murky Auckland dock. And the world was left in shock. But terrorists are not terrorists when doing a job for the nation, carrying out their missions, spotted in salons of power. Petra Kelly, the movement's Joan of Arc, a voice of sanity stifled, for Cain yet one more mark. Petra, you had so much to give, no longer permitted to live. Silenced by the network, the masters of global city. Suicide, the verdict of the shadow men of power. Diane Fossey, your gorillas in the mountain mist are on the road to extinction. One more species for the list. The one who came with sharpened knife to quench the candle of your life was just a drunken minion. Of the world of shady traders and callous trophy hunters, the vampire men of power. Called The Passing Spot. It seems that narrow roads made people more courteous. No road rage in the rural byways. Each driver vying to give way to the other, pull into the honeysuckle verge, and that passing spot that always seemed to appear. There was the smile of thanks. There was the friendly wave that said, "You're welcome." Indicators of quality of life. Nowadays it's not the same. Apoplectic drivers firing dark looks and curses in shiny, powerful cars that fume with auto egomania. Harried people in a hurry. Now there's danger on the narrow roads. Lumbering giant sawmill lorries. Boy racers in macho rally mode. Intrepid city people on four-wheel drive safaris. Well, you can't stop progress, I guess.
Well, we have a wonderful Joan
The wonderful Joseph Wayne.
Oh my God.
Oh, it's very sure the
current person from
now. Now, this is just another little extract from a ghost story. The first part, which I read last week, is about two boys, the narrator and Darren, who have just lost their parents and their house intact. And Darren is crying all the time, he's cranky on. I know I am sometimes hard on Darren, but if I were in any way sympathetic, it would make things worse. In the circumstances, it's understandable that he's cracking up, I suppose, but I have to remain strong for both of us. We've nothing left of the past, nothing but memories. In some ways, I envy Darren. I wish I could cry too. I can't allow myself to grieve. Maybe that's why I'm so angry. He's reminding me of the grief that I myself have buried. I read that in a book in the library the other day. A book telling you how how to deal with death and bereavement and grief and all that kind of thing. The basic point was, I suppose, that our feelings are like living things. You must not bury them until they are dead, or they won't rest in peace. The book didn't put it crudely like that, of course, but I think that was what the writer was getting at. But dealing with death is easier said than done. There are practical things, and I'm the one that has to think of everything now. But I can't allow feelings of grief to gain any kind of foothold or hold finish. I must keep my finger in the dam that is holding my feelings at bay. But I can't stop the memories. I can't stop thinking about the awful thing that happened a few weeks ago when, well, when Dad and Mum were killed in the car crash. That terrible accident changed our lives forever. Before it, we were just boys, sons, brothers, friends to our classmates and neighbours. Now we're something else. We're orphans. Read apart. Part of the great minority. It unnerves me, Darren crying all the time, as if he's not fighting anymore, as if he's giving up. He was never like this when Mum and Dad were alive. But since the accident, he's done little else. He recovered for a while and just became distant and silent, but then when he heard that we would have to leave our old home in Appleton Close as well, well, then the dam really burst. He doesn't seem to realise that the death of our parents has been a terrible blow to me as well. He's not thinking of me at all. Darren is only thinking of himself. It looks like it's going to be up to me to do the thinking for both of us from now on, to plan the future. Act responsibly. I almost feel like I have to be a father to him. I have to make all the decisions to lead the way. I don't like being forced into that, but without Dad and Mum around, there's no choice now. Darren, I say quietly, I really would appreciate it if you could stop crying. I'm trying to disguise the strength of my feelings. I really want to shout at him, but my voice is quiet, so quiet I hardly recognize it as my own, but there must be something in my tone. Did he stop us for a while after that? It really is time Darren grew up. Crying about things doesn't make them go away. In the end, you just have to bring things along with you, stuff them into a suitcase or two, and carry them down the road, whatever shape they are, no matter how heavy. Pain and grief and self-pity and memories, they are all so much baggage. You just got to cram them all inside you and just get on with the business of living, that's all. That's what life is about, dealing with whatever comes along. And after all, nothing is sure except change. Isn't that what they say? Anyway, here we are, sitting in the train now, with Darren crying again, and I, in an effort to escape his sniffled and red face, still hovering in my mind around the old house in Appleton Close. I have loved that old house and loved it forever. I even love the name, Appleton, nice and red and fruity. I think for a long time to come, I will be walking down it, and always for the last time, backwards and forwards in my memories like someone in a dream. Slowly, between the old chestnut trees and on the leaf-strewn path, not wanting to leave.
So that's Paul, by the way. Now, we got Peter Lucy. Peter.
I'm going to read a poem called One Evening by Robert Bruchan, I think. I don't have a very special reason for reading it, but the poem is about a man, I believe, who was visited by his dead lover. One evening in the dying light, as I wait for the old guy, she would come to my pillow. So dead for years. I'll see her young face and listen. Remember our nuptials, our ardors that night in the big house of echoes, the ceaseless croon of the bay, I'll cough and mumble. How could I forget you, sweet lady of the manor? Our cup brimming over, and it's forever. Sleep now, she would say, and take my knotted hand. I'll sleep and dream and sleep, the seas croon in my ears, as I float away to Ultima Thule.
Theater. We have Anne-Marie Gretton. The poem I'm going to read now, it's up to yourselves if you want to or not, but don't everybody close your eyes and just try to imagine it. It's up to yourselves, like I said, you don't have to
wait, close your eyes to make it.
I promise something happens, I'll let you know. Select the doctor's out of the chance when you can, right? Close your eyes. Can you see it? Mountains grow taller and taller. Suddenly they burst open, and all the white horses break free. They come pouring out, they come galloping, crashing, racing. Gathering together to create a wall, they chase, speed, run, jump towards the sandy bank. So slowly they begin to glide as they get closer. On each episode onto the bank, turning into soft white snow, foam, a lightness that the wind crazily caresses and carries into the air and onto the land. Floating like snow, your heart beats so fast, the stormy wind sending exhilarating shivers through you as it whirls and dances around you, knocking at you, daring to tip you yet not. As you breathe in, you take salt. As you breathe out, you feel the sea. Horses gallop for you. Open your eyes. You're at the brink of the world. A breath catches in you as you dare to open your mouth. It spreads like wildfire in ocean. To you, a thousand miles of white carpet. And miles, miles below. Breathtaking, pure astonishment, pure dream. Words that try to escape you but fail. Words that are carried away on white horses and lost forever. An eruption of white spray dashes from the Yellow Sea as the white creatures went to hit sharp, jagged spikes that plunge from nowhere. A rumble of thunder hits your ears, but not from the sky, but from below. Deep, deep down, a whistling follows as the wind gets around you, ripping your hair out. It entwines you in this mass of a storm, a battle, a war. Clouds shift from the sky, a drop of light appears. A further shift where it comes gushing out, covering you in warmth, wrapping itself around you. Now the white horse is gleaming, sparkling, as they toss and turn, as they dance. It's magical, reality ceasing to exist. Time lost, just you and this all-escaping mystery, a world of wonder, just you and this.
I'm going to actually to read you a most fantastic one, if I say it to myself, and that would quite literally be very emotive. I say in all the human emotions and quite conceivably and possibly change your lives. Unfortunately, I haven't written it yet. But anyway, you'll be the first to hear it. In the meantime, you have to make do with these two humble conditions instead. I was just thinking what I would read earlier on, and we think of stunt comedy, one anger dipped into the darkness last week a little bit. So this poem I'm going to read from my collection of about 7 of the poems, it's got illustrations that you can colour in, or your children can colour in if you have any. And it's quite an inoffensive poem, really. It's quite simplicity, to be honest, but it's the kind of thing that for some reason or other would remind you perhaps of Gay Horn in his crime. Just imagine Gay reading this kind of thing on a morning radio show. It's called, typically enough, Gay, the Friendship Cake. And there's a verse for everyone in the audience, of course. It's friendship is a
the cake, what flavor would have been? What ingredients would make a sweet and perfect blend? You gave her spectre from the heart and pouring your affection, and tears and laughter next to the part of this binding confection. And some sharing to it too, and a great see you smile, and a helping out by time for you, and not the least more style. Get honesty high on the list, with compassion here as well. Make sure true feelings are not missed, understanding makes it show. Be not surprised at good taste, kind words promote flavor. Fond memories won't go to waste, and a hug is good flavor. Okay, season it with history, but not in bonds like trust, and a pinch or two of mystery, add spice and the must. That is the mix I think you need to make a friendship sweet. That recipe may help you feed the next stranger that you meet.
Anyway, as we're in the barrel, please enjoy the poetry poems responsibly. Do not get intoxicated by the words from anybody else, especially if you're writing. Speaking of which, there's a man arrested in Bignol last week. I'm going to tell you about it now. It's called A Garda Dilemma. A bloke that I know got caught in the act, interfered with a squad car, as a matter of fact. Interfered in a way in which was chewably wrong. He claimed the blue light at the top turned him on. To further compound the man's situation, the alluring white car was marked outside the station, and those irate moral gardens were mapped on the scene to arrest his attempt to molest their machine. The marshal inside sat down to discuss how best they would punish his deviant lust. A variety of cops were there at the table, some angry, some grim, some quite dim, some unstable. First scary cop said with a hideous grin, the dogs haven't beaten child enemy. But Sadus cop pointed to a PowerPoint and said, it's wired to death for a few hours instead. I know it's a kinky cop if you hold him still, too heavy smoke pipe cop on the ESP bill. It's roast him, said crew cop on a barbecue skewer. A good fry agreed drunk cop is great for the cure. Yeah. Same cop suggested they shave off his hair. Why don't we send smelly cop to deprive him of air? So someone proposed fat cop sit on his face. Would you mind, said the gay cop, if I took that cop's name? I'll cure him, said his girl cop of the urge to molest. Just give me 5 minutes alone with the pest. Then angry cop roared, it's a terrible one for a man. Don't put him in touch with a fine ambulance. Why not, inquired Pink Cop, let the man himself choose. Take his trimmings, his mafia cop with lead in his shoes. And Garber Cop asked, why change our old style? Can't we just pop his head off the wall for a while? We could free him, said Pink Cop, if he's willing to pay. No, Titus Dracop, let's not go astray. Let's starve him, said Pink Cop, that he disappears. Nothing worse, the great. The press cop collapsing in tears. Bully cop wanted a pinch of the dead. Gambling cop fancied some Russian roulette. Bully cop said they should pray for direction. Razor cop prayed and they cried, intersection! High cop insisted they show some restraint. As nervous cop peered and fell down his face. Branding the prisoner was cowboy cop's choice. I knew it said fox cop. Was no solution than marriage by which they could abide. So the matter was left to wise cop to decide. Did we do? He talked for a while, then declared, I decree that a perverted prisoner be allowed to go free. We may have to mount a guard on the squad, though not as our friend would mount it, by God. He's dangerous to cars, he could damage a bus. But we must never forget, he's still one of us.
Now, do we or do we not have Alan Tipsy? This is kind of a cynical story as usual. I worked out on my way here that there's only 277 days to Christmas. Obviously somebody else knows that as well. So it's called Another Way, right? When the wise men left the stable, they knew they had a problem. They had promised Herod that they would go back to his palace and tell him what they had seen and where he would find the baby king. They had given him their word, and yet they felt the word was not good enough. There was something in his sincere smile, in the whiteness of his teeth, in the firm clasp of his hand, in the direct look into his eyes, in his unfailing courtesy. There was something in his entirely plausible manner that made him hesitate. "We're in a hurry anyway," said the brown one. "I don't think there's much good in hanging around. I think we should get out of here fast." "Can't agree at all," said the yellow-white person. "We must, of course, keep our word even though the skies fall in. We must tell them about the baby." "God will provide," said the brown sage. "Remember, we did promise honesty, openness, and transparency. We can't escape duty. Duty is paramount. I just don't know what the problem is." "The problem is," said the dark, white man, "that we have a feeling that we shouldn't put our trust in princes. That, as we say now, he had an agenda, that what we saw isn't what we got, that he was, as they say, having us on." "But it is said that the prince's word is his bond," said a bronze woman in reply. "Why should we doubt the prince's word?" "Just because he's a prince," said the brown one, packing his bags. "We should doubt the prince's word just precisely because he's a prince. He may be a man, but a prince is a prince for all that." "And anyway, there was your man," said the black wise man, who never said much because he thought that he never had much to say. "The guy in white with the funny shoulders and the pale face and the thin voice." "So what?" said Bronzy. "He didn't give any reason. Besides, we might get lost. Remember, we had a star to guide us on our way here. The star was that has gone down or out to the west. We need to do what we know. We need to obey the king. We need to keep our word." "All he said was that we should go back another way," said the wise one with his ruddy complexion. "Who does he think he is, some kind of cartographer?" "I think you missed the point," said the black one from the south, the one who never said much because he had little enough to say. "Just remember what we saw. Just remember the gifts we brought, the hard coming we had of it. All he told us was that we should go back another way. Wasn't that why we came here? If we didn't come here to go back another way, then what was it all about?" Very serious.